Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, who discusses her concerns about President Obama's nominee, Elena Kagan, to replace retiring Justice John Paul Stevens on the U.S. Supreme Court. Sari Bashi, the executive director of Gisha, who describes a campaign to outlaw Israeli human rights groups who defend the rights of Palestinians. And BBC TV investigative journalist Greg Pallast, who looks at British Petroleum's reckless pattern of behavior from their role in the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska to the current disastrous oil rig spill in the Gulf of Mexico. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In cities across the UK, voters were denied their franchise in a tightly contested three-way race that failed to select a clear winner. As polls closed at 10 p.m., police were called out to disperse voters who were still waiting to cast ballots in places as diverse as London, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, and Sheffield. Jenny Watson, head of Britain's Electoral Commission, called for an investigation into the Election Day foul-up. She blamed the voter snarl on the highest voter turnout in 30 years and an antiquated voting system. Joanne Slaughter, who was turned away from a voting station in the Hackney South constituency in London, told the BBC, "It is an outrage in a civilized country like ours that this can happen, especially to people who are trying to vote after doing a day's work." Long lines also delayed balloting in Sheffield, a Liberal Democratic stronghold. As polls closed, over 200 voters were turned away, including university students who had been diverted into separate, slower-moving lines. The National Union of Students issued a protest, stating that this set a poor example for first-time voters. British human rights lawyer Jeffrey Robertson says voters who were turned away from the polls can sue for compensation, noting the European Convention guarantees the right to vote. Hopes ran high for a breakthrough in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks when Barack Obama was elected president. But prospects quickly dimmed with Israel's deadly incursion into the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip days before Obama took office. According to the American Prospect magazine, the Obama administration failed to develop new thinking about U.S. Middle East policy options. Once in the White House, the Obama team did not forcefully react to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Thousands died, more than 300 schools were destroyed, and 20,000 Gazans remained displaced as a result of the Israeli assault. U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell has avoided visiting Gaza, unlike other prominent Western leaders such as United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and U.S. Senator John Kerry. The Obama administration has continued the Bush policy of isolating Hamas while negotiating with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. Some critics assert that the failure to engage with Hamas has taken the pressure off the Palestinian Authority, which has become more inflexible and ineffective in its negotiating stance with Israel. Retired Marine Sergeant Hermógenes Marrero is waiting for his day in court. The retired Special Forces Marine claims he has contracted colon cancer and Lou Gehrig's disease as a result of his exposure to the chemical weapons he guarded for the U.S. Navy on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Sergeant Marrero is the lead plaintiff in a massive class-action suit brought by the citizens of Vieques against the U.S. Navy. The American government used the island as a military base and bombing range from 1941 to 2003. Marrero was stationed on Vieques for 18 months in the early 1970s, where he was exposed to toxic chemicals like Agent Orange and napalm. The retired Marine told a news magazine In These Times, "I did not know how dangerous these chemicals were, because it was on a need-to-know basis." For years now, residents of Vieques have been diagnosed with cancer at a rate 30% higher than the rest of Puerto Rico. Citizens on the island also have triple the rate of high blood pressure and an increased incidence of diabetes. Federal District Court Judge Daniel Dominguez must decide whether or not to move forward with the 2007 lawsuit filed by 7,000 Vieques residents. Meanwhile, the U.S. government claims it has sovereign immunity from the lawsuit against the Navy. In 2005, the EPA designated Vieques a federal Superfund site for toxic materials, despite the fact that napalm, Agent Orange, depleted uranium, arsenic, and other hazardous chemicals remain on the island. The Navy continues to assert that nobody on Vieques was harmed by its activity. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On May 10th, President Obama announced his nominee to replace soon-to-retire Justice John Paul Stevens on the U.S. Supreme Court, Elena Kagan, who is currently the administration's Solicitor General. Kagan, the first female president of Harvard Law School, has never served as a judge and has taken few public stands on judicial issues. In announcing his nominee, President Obama praised Kagan as open to different points of view and being a consensus builder, citing her hiring of conservative faculty at Harvard. Supporters of the Kagan nomination maintain she has the capacity to build new coalitions on the court and possibly sway Justice Anthony Kennedy a swing vote on major issues. But many progressive activists are troubled by Obama's Supreme Court pick, citing Kagan's testimony during her Senate confirmation hearing as Solicitor General, when she voiced support for executive powers adopted by President Bush to indefinitely hold terrorist suspects without charge or trial. Critics also cite her lack of diverse hiring practices when she was president of Harvard Law School. Despite upholding a Harvard ruling to prohibit military recruitment on campus due to the discriminatory "don't ask, don't tell" rules until faced with a loss of federal funds, critics are disturbed that Kagan was virtually silent during President Bush's invocation of extraordinary executive powers of torture and detention. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who explains why she feels Kagan will not be able to fill the shoes of Justice John Paul Stevens, who many view as a stalwart defender of individual liberties and human dignity.
Well, I think Obama is speaking to the right-wingers, the Republicans. He wants her nomination to sail through, and that's his main goal, I think, here, by saying that she hired conservatives on the Harvard faculty. Well, that's well and good, and of course the conservatives are going to like that. But she also, out of the 32 tenured and tenure-track faculty that she hired, only 7 were women, only 1 was a minority, an Asian woman, no African Americans, no Latinos. So she's really a blank slate. We don't know much about her positions. She hasn't been a judge, and that is not a disqualification. Chief Justice Rehnquist, Lewis Powell were not judges before they joined the Supreme Court. She's been an academic for some 20 years, but she's also left very little paper trail there as well. Most professors who have been law professors, and certainly tenured law professors and law professors at schools, eminent schools, such as the ones she's taught at, University of Chicago and Harvard, have scholarly writings that take positions on constitutional issues and that are quoted and cited. She has nothing like that. She has a paucity of legal scholarship, a few articles, and they've been described as dull and tedious. I think one of the most objectionable things about Elena Kagan is that during the Bush administration, when George W. Bush was spying on U.S. citizens without a warrant, was holding men and small and boys in small cages at Guantanamo without charges indefinitely, when his administration was setting policies that led to the torture and abuse of prisoners and sending prisoners to other countries to be tortured, many, many law professors spoke out, including myself, spoke out, wrote, complained. I wrote a book about it. Many people did. She said nothing. Elena Kagan said nothing. She did not complain. She was not part of government then. She was not part of the Bush administration, and yet she remained silent. I don't know if she has no opinion on these things or if she was just cautiously waiting until she gets appointed to the Supreme Court and didn't want to do anything controversial. But that is really objectionable, in my opinion. And when she had her confirmation hearing for Solicitor General, she said some very telling things, and we have to look at that because she doesn't have a lot of writings to her credit. When Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican, said, "Are we at war?" And she said, "Yes, we're at war." And he says it's a war without end, and she agreed. And so she agreed that the criminal law doesn't apply and people could be held indefinitely without charges. This war on terror is really a misnomer. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. You don't declare war on a tactic. And yet this war on terror, this so-called war on terror, has been used by the Bush administration and is now being used by the Obama administration, which is following a lot of the Bush policies, unfortunately, to justify really shredding the Constitution. And so when she agreed with Lindsey Graham, that really was concerning and disconcerting.
Marjorie, Elena Kagan argued the case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission for the Obama administration in opposition to the eventual outcome of that case, where the Supreme Court reversed decades of precedent and equated corporate rights with human rights. Could we tell anything about Elena Kagan's judicial philosophy from how she argued that case?
You know, I think we're guessing. I mean, she's a hired gun. She has to do what her boss says. You can say, well, she might disagree with some of the policies of the Obama administration that she had to argue. You could also say that she might agree with some of them, such as Citizens United. We're speculating. We don't know. Once again, she's a blank slate. She really has not given us much of an indication of where she comes down on these things. Now, if she really did disagree vehemently with the things she was asked to do, presumably she would have quit, although she seems to be much too political for that. But I think that it's hard to read into her arguing on behalf of her boss, the president, any agreement or disagreement with any of the policies that she's being asked to argue.
Marjorie, another thing that's being said by those who favor Elena Kagan's nomination is that she's a bridge builder and she can make an alliance with a crucial vote on the current Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, and that the thought is that her temperament will allow her to convince Kennedy to come on over to some, you know, liberal opinions in the future court. Does this make sense to you? I mean, this seems like a real kind of three-dimensional chess match, which is not possible to play as I look at it.
Well, it's not just a matter of temperament. Chief Justice Roberts has been masterful in convincing Kennedy to come to the conservative side, to the right-wing side in most decisions. And Justice Roberts has been a judge. He has that judicial experience, and I think that that it's going to make it more difficult for Elena Kagan to do that because she doesn't have that judicial experience. Now, she certainly will acquire it as she's on the court. There's another problem, too, Scott, and that is that she will likely recuse herself from many of the decisions that she was when she was involved with the case as Solicitor General. So assuming she would be ruling against unbridled executive power in some of the so-called war on terror cases, she won't have a vote. She will be recusing herself, and that means that those cases will go to the conservatives. She is clearly moving the court to the right, both for that reason and for the reason that she apparently, from these things that she said to Lindsey Graham during her confirmation hearing, does not agree with the so-called liberals on the court who have stood up to the Bush administration in his war on terror the way Stevens did. So I don't think there's any doubt that she is going to move the court to the right.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She is the author of Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Read her articles online at marjoriecohn.com. Human rights organizations in Israel, especially those that defend the rights of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, are facing a new threat to their operations since a bill was introduced in the Israeli Knesset, or parliament, that could prohibit foreign funding for these civil society groups. Among the groups targeted are Rabbis for Human Rights, Coalition of Women for Peace, and Gisha, which defend freedom of movement for Palestinians, focused especially in Gaza. The group has filed lawsuits heard up to the Israeli Supreme Court, trying to force Israel to allow fuel and other supplies into Gaza, which has been under an Israeli blockade since Hamas took control of the territory in 2007. The bill aims to prohibit the registration of or to close down any existing non-governmental organization if there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the group is providing information to foreign entities or is involved in legal proceedings abroad against senior Israeli government officials or Israeli military officers for violation of international law or war crimes. The largest financial supporter of human rights groups in Israel, the New Israel Fund, has been targeted by the Israeli right as being responsible for a majority of the critical information gathered in the United Nations Goldstone Report, which found that Israel had committed war crimes during its 2008 Gaza invasion. Sari Bashi, the executive director of Gisha, is a graduate of the Yale University Law School and spoke at the school in April about the interconnection of human rights in Israel and Palestine.
Both the erosion of human rights for Palestinians and the erosion of democratic protections for Israeli human rights defenders have to do with a crisis in values, a crisis of democratic values, of universalistic values. A democracy that is maintaining a military occupation, which is obviously non-democratic, cannot maintain these Chinese walls. It's going to spill over in ways that are going to be detrimental. And it always has. But now it seems to be more extreme. There's always been a pendulum that swung back and forth between the government's ability to tolerate dissent and to protect the rights of freedom of association, freedom of speech for people who criticize the government. But the last year, since the Gaza war, it swung in one direction in a way that I have not seen before. I have not seen it this bad, and it doesn't show any signs of swinging back anytime soon. So I don't know where we are right now. We're in some kind of transition. What am I talking about? Well, the readings talked about this law that would restrict the ability of human rights groups to get funding. That initiative is taking place in a context of a coordinated government campaign against human rights groups within Israel in the wake of criticism over the Gaza war. There's been a media campaign in which government spokespersons have spread misinformation about human rights groups, characterizing us as a fifth column, calling us a strategic threat, traitors, calling us agents of European anti-Semites, and making it seem as though we're operating secretly, when actually, as human rights groups, we believe in transparency, so we try to operate as transparently as possible. The foreign ministry has created a special unit that is designed to combat Israeli human rights groups. There have been attempts to obstruct funding to prevent our ability to get funding from abroad, either through legislation making it difficult or impossible, or through political moves where the Netanyahu government has actually approached different European countries who fund human rights groups through these kind of neighborhood programs in support of human rights and said, don't fund groups that criticize us. And also the use of the tax law. The tax law is being used to do what I would call harass human rights groups. This summer, the tax authority tried to remove our tax-exempt status because we defend Palestinians. I'm glad to say so far we've survived that particular attempt, but it's not just us. There are other groups that are being targeted as well. There have also been arrests of peaceful demonstrators, of Israeli Jews. When Palestinian demonstrators, Palestinian citizens of Israel, were arrested, the government could couch that as a security threat. Now they're arresting Israeli Jews as well, where it's not about a security threat. They say, no, this is an illegal demonstration. There's no violence, but we're not going to let it take place. And, you know, these are all symptoms of what I would call a crisis of values. Israel is self-defined as a Jewish and a democratic state. And that would mean that you have particularistic values, values of protecting the Jewish people, and you have universal values, which are democratic values, international law, human rights, which belong to everybody by virtue of being human. And there's always been some kind of uneasy tension and balance. We're now shifting in one particular direction. And it creates a challenge, I should say, for human rights groups, because not just in terms of our legal activity, but also in terms of our public advocacy, we're fighting for communicability. We're promoting values of universal human rights, of individual rights, of democracy, of freedom. And increasingly, the values that are being promoted in the public sphere and in the political sphere are values of particularistic self-defense. It's us against them. The them is dehumanized. And even people who look like us, even Israeli human rights groups, are part of the them if they criticize. On the one hand, there's a crisis. On the other hand, I'm actually a little bit optimistic because we're in a transition. And I don't know what we're transitioning to, but I think there are opportunities here, if we can do it right, wake people up inside Israel to to say, look, you and I may not agree about what the policy should be in the occupied territory, but maybe you're also worried that I'm getting arrested. And maybe you can understand that there's a price to these particularistic values about something you care about, because maybe you care about Israeli democracy. And maybe we can get that conversation to expand to human rights.
That was Sari Bashi, executive director of the Israeli human rights group, Gisha. For more information, visit the website at gisha.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Despite several attempts to stop the flood of oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico from their destroyed Deepwater Horizon oil platform, British Petroleum has not yet succeeded. Their first attempt, using robotic submarines to shut down valves at the wellhead 5,000 feet below the surface, failed. Then the company tried to lower a 100-ton containment dome over the well, but ice crystals inside made the dome buoyant and unstable. Now, BP is considering using a smaller dome or injecting the well with golf balls and shredded car tires to clog the oil well. There have been initial reports of crude oil from the disaster washing ashore along the coast, and several birds with oil-stained feathers have been rescued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Sun-Herald newspaper of Mississippi reported that since BP's oil rig exploded on April 20th, the Obama administration has granted at least 27 waivers to oil and gas companies, exempting them from carrying out environmental impact studies of oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico. This, despite a pledge from Obama to prevent more damage in the Gulf and the announcement of a temporary halt to offshore drilling. U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is calling for the Minerals Management Service to be broken up so collection of oil royalties and safety inspections of offshore drilling are separated, responding to critics who say the agency is riddled with conflicts of interest. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with BBC TV reporter Greg Palast, who investigated the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill for the Chukog Native villages of Alaska's Prince William Sound. In his recent article, Slick Operator, the BP I've Known Too Well, Palast examines British Petroleum's disturbing pattern of behavior, both in Alaska and during the company's current drill platform oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
I was in charge of the investigation into fraud, possible fraud, in the grounding of the Exxon Valdez and the disaster. And what I concluded then, this is 20 years ago, after 3 years of investigation, was that while Exxon had its name on the boat Exxon Valdez, the real culprit, the real corporation that slimed over 1,000 miles of Alaskan coast, was British Petroleum, whose name is nowhere. And here's exactly what they did. This is a company that commits continuing fraud. I don't say that lightly, especially because I work in Britain under British libel laws. For example, in Alaska in 89 when the Exxon Valdez hit, it wasn't the fact that the ship hit that it slimed or that you had a blowout in the Gulf that everything gets covered with oil. You can contain the oil. That was British Petroleum's job in Alaska. They had promised in writing that they would have the stuff you need to control a spill, which is, by the way, not rocket science, Scott. It's real simple. When a ship goes aground and breaks open, a tanker, or oil well blows out, you surround the whole area with rubber sheets, with rubber skirts called boom. And then you bring in skim boats and you suck the stuff out. You may drop some dispersant in to break it up, but basically you surround it and remove it. That's what British Petroleum promised to do. But that requires a lot of equipment, and that equipment may be simple, but it costs millions and millions, and it adds up to billions and billions, and that they wouldn't do. So, for example, in Alaska, the Exxon Valdez ship hit at Bligh Reef. British Petroleum had promised to actually have the rubber skirting, the emergency supplies, on Bligh Island right there. And you can practically reach over from the ship and grab the emergency equipment. The problem was the emergency equipment wasn't there. They signed off and said it was there, but it wasn't, because they figured, who's going to check, you know, among the icebergs and, you know, Indians up there, the natives? And then they were supposed to have emergency response crews, same in the Gulf. You have to have a 24/7 crew to put that rubber out. It's just like a fire department. You know, there may not be a fire every minute, but you have a full-time fire department, right? The natives were hired as the full-time response crew and given them the equipment to do it, including helicopters. And then they decided to save money, and they fired all the natives. So when the Exxon ran aground, the natives were standing on the beach at Tetitlik Village watching the ship hit the reef. They could actually see this ship coming closer and closer to the village, which is right near Bligh Reef. It hit the reef. They could have been out there, grabbed the rubber skirting off of Bligh Island. If they had the authority and equipment, they were still on the payroll, and the equipment was still there, as it was supposed to be. The Exxon Valdez would have been surrounded in a few hours. You would have never even heard about this grounding. It might have been a one-day story. We wouldn't be talking about the Exxon Valdez 20 years later. They did the same thing in the Gulf. They were given a waiver for the Deepwater Horizon having a special plan. They didn't need one because they did have a fairly decent plan for all their Gulf drills. The problem is it was a complete lie. It was a fabrication. It was nonsense. They said they had all this rubber skirting and the skimmers, and they didn't have them.
Greg, is that a violation of law? Is this a strict requirement that they have this equipment ready to go in the event of a spill, and did they violate the law?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know this stuff of like, oh, we didn't expect this. What do you mean you didn't expect it? First of all, you're supposed to expect it because the whole point of an accident is that you're supposed to say what can happen. What's the worst possible accident? And they had a worst possible accident scenario for their other Gulf wells. So where was the boom? Where was the rubber skirting? The U.S. Navy was able to get contractors to bring out 7 miles of rubber skirting within hours of the U.S. Navy being given the job.
Well, Greg, as you point out in the article, a lot of the lack of government oversight on safety, health, and environment really began in a very harsh way under President Ronald Reagan and continued under Democrats Bill Clinton and Al Gore when they were in office. And this oil spill and the lack of really strict government requirements for safety devices to prevent a spill like this in the Gulf have been waived or just ignored. The results are apparent right now in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes. So we have this anti-regulatory fanaticism, which is spread through both parties. It was Al Gore, Nobel Prize-winning bearded Al Gore, who was the one who headed Clinton's deregulation committee, which basically cut the heart out of environmental regulations and other regulations. And obviously, we know about Clinton's deregulation banking. It's all of one piece. And by the way, when you look at those, the snake dancing going on at those teabagger parties, where does the money come from? I tell you right now, it's coming from oil interests. The big money behind the teabaggers is Koch Industries, which is an oil and gas company owned by the Koch brothers. And it's all about loosening up the environmental regulations on oil.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast. Read his articles online at gregpalast.com. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, An Armed Madhouse. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.